Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, offering new and used vehicles to help Mainers explore the beauty of their home state. Learn more at leeauto.com.
This is Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz, along with Maine Public's Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler and Senior Political Correspondent Mal Leary. Welcome back. Politics was certainly overshadowed for a time as the coronavirus pandemic reached Maine. The legislature folded up shop early and Governor Mills exercised her powers to shut down much economic activity, forcing Mainers to stay separated. That appears to have had the desired effect, easing the increased pressure hospitals here were under, though the state never got as bad as my native New York City. But as the crisis atmosphere has waned, politics has been reasserting itself. Steve Missler, what's your read on the politics of the pandemic?
Well, Erwin, I think it largely mirrors what you're seeing on the national level, which is this tension between restrictions designed to flatten the curve of the outbreak and a desire to restart the economy. But that tension strikes me as more acute in Maine and other states, quite frankly. And that's because the White House has pretty much decided that the states are on their own. And so decisions such as shutdowns and reopenings are being handled by state governments. And in Maine, the pandemic response is effectively being handled by one person and her administration. That's Governor Janet Mills. And as you noted, Erwin, the legislature adjourned early and they expanded the governor's emergency powers so that she could react quickly to the pandemic. And early on, that seemed to work out okay because the governor could act quickly and unilaterally to respond to the pandemic. But not having those pesky legislators around also cuts another way. It means that Governor Mills owns every single decision. And so what you're seeing now is a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking from her political opponents who not only don't have to make any of these decisions, but they also might benefit politically if they can convince voters in November that these decisions are doing more harm than good. And you're seeing that with some Republican lawmakers, and even Mills' predecessor, Governor LePage, are basically drafting off anger from business owners who are really worried that the governor's pandemic restrictions are killing the tourist season, for example. And some of this criticism is definitely fair game, I mean, and worthy of scrutiny, especially when, you know, examining which industries are allowed to reopen, when and where. But there have also been some pretty wild claims that the governor is deliberately shuttering the economy for nefarious purposes, a claim that only really makes sense if you somehow believe that Mills is deliberately tanking state revenues and sabotaging her own policy agenda. Because, I mean, after all, budget and programming cuts are the inevitable result of declining tax revenues. And that's because we don't have deficit spending here like the federal government does. But this is politics, so little details like that don't always matter.
Mal, is there any way to know who might have an advantage in a political fight like this?
Absolutely not. It's chaotic as hell. It's almost every single decision that, as Steve points out, the governor makes, she has to buy. And she constantly is trying to weigh the health versus the economy. You know, we're not talking about a far liberal governor who's out there to implement some agenda. I mean, she got elected, I think, because she was middle of the road, conservative, practical, and that is what she's trying to apply. The problem is there's always winners, there's always losers. We're seeing right now among the business community, there are far more losers than winners.
Steve, I noticed that even Republicans in the second congressional district seem to be making Governor Mills the focus of their campaigns. Does that make any sense?
Well, on its face, it doesn't, especially since a member of Congress can't really do anything about any of the governor's decisions except make a lot of noise about it. But I do think these attacks do have some utility in appealing to some Republican primary voters. And I say that for a couple of reasons. I mean, first, attacking Mills is a lot easier right now than going after Congressman Jared Golden, who is the incumbent that they're purportedly trying to unseat here, because her decisions are actually more top of mind. And right now, more immediately impactful for Maine residents. It's also a way for Golden's challengers to get some recognition. And let's face it, some of these GOP challengers could definitely use it. I mean, they're really not that well known to people who don't follow state politics as closely as Mal and I do, for example. And I think the second reason that they're doing it is that there's likely a segment of the GOP primary electorate that sees the pandemic restrictions as a real problem for President Trump's reelection. So these restrictions are designed to limit economic activity. Well, the president desperately needs economic activity to return in order to bolster his reelection hopes, which have been hurt by the White House's response to the pandemic, not to mention his own conduct. And I think that's why Trump spent so much time attacking Mills when he arrived here a couple of weeks ago and visited the swab factory in Guilford. He desperately needs an economic revival. And because he's essentially left all the tough decisions to the states, he now sees governors like Mills as an impediment to his electoral chances because she's still trying to manage the pandemic.
Well, we've got to look at the reality here of the second congressional district candidates really floundering. None of their traditional campaign techniques can be used. Door to door is not going to happen. The state convention, which always in the past has provided an opportunity for one or more candidates to kind of come out of the woodwork and show that they have strength among the party, that's not happening. We see this totally different world of campaigning that is based on virtual town meetings where basically they're inviting their own people to come and talk to them. And the Democrats are doing the same thing. I'm not being critical here of just the Republicans. How do you get across to voters what you're doing when everything is totally different in terms of how you campaign? And I think that's why it's like attacking Janet Mills is easy, because there's always somebody who's upset with the decision she's made about something.
Mal, do you see the same kind of dynamic at work in the Senate race, where Republican Susan Collins is seeking her fifth term?
Well, to some extent, but you've got Sarah Gideon, who's acting like she's already won her primary. And quite frankly, the National Democratic Party organizations are also following suit. So we're seeing these huge numbers of television ads, and they're reaching people who are home in a situation they don't want to be home. And it's one ad after another. And it's Collins ad, and then a surrogate, and then a surrogate for Gideon, and then a Gideon ad. So in sense of traditional campaigning, yeah, they're doing all these TV ads, but it's so early in the process to see ads out, and in some cases, you know, some pretty strong attack ads, as opposed to what you normally would be seeing, where, hey, there's a real primary here and you got to win it first. In terms of the Democrats, obviously Collins has no opposition, so she wouldn't be spending money now if Gideon wasn't spending money.
Steve, I wonder too, I mean, is there a lot of the spending on the Democratic side has been very heavily for Sarah Gideon. Does that leave any room for either of her two opponents to actually win that primary?
Well, it's a lot tougher, especially in this environment, because as Mal just explained, right, the meetings, the house parties that a lot of candidates attend when as they try to court and woo not just voters, but party leaders or just local leaders that can, just by the virtue of transference, help garner support. It's a lot harder for Betsy Sweet and Bree Kidman, the two other Democrats that are running, to organize a campaign like that. And because so much of the money has been funneled to Sarah Gideon, it's kind of choked off the availability of money for Kidman and Sweet. Their only option is to do whatever they can in this restrictive environment. But in a scenario that Mal just laid out for you, it's going to be a lot harder for them, even harder than it already would have been if they were allowed to do door-to-door stuff or retail campaigning or town halls or whatever that would normally take place right now. It's twice as hard for those candidates that are on the outside looking in, at least in terms of money and being able to get their message out on your traditional platforms like television and even digital ads. One thing I will say that I have noticed to kind of keep the thread here with the pandemic is that with the Collins campaign and her Republican surrogates, what you're seeing is an attempt to draw a real contrast between what Susan Collins is doing and helping to secure funding, pandemic funding for the state. Of course, this is what all senators and all members of Congress are doing right now. But Susan Collins can come out and say, hey, I secured this much money that's going to help with Maine ramp up or expand its testing capacity, this sort of thing. And so what Collins's campaign is doing is they're going directly after Gideon, assuming again that she is the front runner, and they're going after her and saying, hey, where's Sarah Gideon? You know, the legislature's been out for over 90 days and you know, and they've created this hashtag, which is, you know, Sarah did nothing. And there's like this countdown every day on social media about what Sarah Gideon has not done. That's the contrast they're trying to draw right now. And that's how they're utilizing the politics of the pandemic to try to exploit or to, you know, to gain an advantage. It is interesting too, because it also dovetails with a strategy that the Collins campaign did early on before we had a pandemic, which was to basically try to remind or tell people that Susan Collins brings home the pork from Washington. You know, she has all these connections. She's relevant there. And therefore, you know, if she were to go away, voters, you know, your chances of getting any of this aid, whether it's highway funding aid or whatever, will be diminished. They're trying to draw a contrast. And they're also trying to say that Sarah Gideon is a gamble, that, you know, you don't want to gamble with Gideon. That is another hashtag they're trying to get some traction with. It's an interesting campaign, and it's all related to the pandemic, as Mel pointed out.
And the reality here is that we're in such uncharted territory. Every single political scientist I've talked to is saying, we don't know what a July 14th primary is going to look like, except we do have one indicator that an awful lot of people are voting absentee. Astounding numbers, actually. More than double have been requested already than were requested 2 years ago when we had races in both the Democrat and Republican primaries for governor, which generated a lot of interest. And we all thought, boy, there's a lot of absentee ballots. Well, that's been blown right out of the window now. Political scientists keep reminding me, is July in Maine, really? People are going to focus on primaries? No, they're not. They're trying to make the best of a bad situation. What are they doing? Well, they're thinking about, how am I going to survive if Congress doesn't extend unemployment benefits or payback under the Paycheck Protection Program? That's what you're seeing from folks that are out of work, be they businessmen who are out of work or their employees.
Yeah, I kind of wonder, though, does that perhaps from the campaign standpoint, with so many absentee ballots kind of already out there and more likely to go out there, does that make them think that perhaps this campaign will really be peaking over the next week to 10 days, rather than in the last week or so before the July 14th vote?
Yeah, I was just about to add on to that, Erwin, you pointed it out before I did. But that window, usually the week before the election or the primary in this case, or 2 weeks even, that's when you see this ramp up of intensity of it, whether they're attacks or contrast ads, whatever you prefer to call them. That's when you would typically see them. I expect that they'll probably come much earlier because people are voting earlier. The numbers are there. Mal just cited them. Because people are, you know, they may not want to go to the polls. They don't think it's safe, or there may be a dearth of poll workers, which we know that's the case. That's been widely reported. And so, you know, if that's the case and people are going to vote from home, that means they're making decisions early. And that means that the traditional campaign, the window when you would see things really intensify, which is typically closer to the actual election, I think has just been pushed out. I think that's exactly what you're going to see, though, is activity that would traditionally happen closer to an election happen now.
The tipping point in this race could be next week or 2 weeks from now, when a big flood of absentees come in because people have decided how they're going to vote. And they've cast their ballot and they're off onto the other things of summer that we all want to do.
All right, Mal, Steve, thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. We're going back on our regular schedule, which means you can find the Pulse online or wherever you get your podcasts, beginning sometime on Friday afternoons. We also replay most of the Pulse on Weekend Edition Sunday and an excerpt of it on Morning Edition Monday. Willis Reiter Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz. Thanks for joining us.